This is the Observation Podcast for, I was about to say Friday, but it's not that, is it? It's Sunday, 19th of November, 2023. As always, it's a pleasure to have you at the, watching on the podcast. I am Dale Franks.
And I'm Michael Wade.
Michael Wade is having a delicious beverage, which, by the way, reminds me, I probably should have refilled my delicious beverage before the podcast. Unfortunately, I did not do that. I also didn't go pee either, so this may be a shorter broadcast than usual. Who knows? In any event, it's always great to be back on the podcast with you. And just to kick it off today, I noted that this weekend, a libertarian managed to do something in Argentina that none have ever managed to do in the United States. The libertarian presidential candidate Javier Milei has won the presidency. Both him and I'm presuming his anarcho-capitalist heir is also going to be the vice president. It's a big move for a country that has largely been run by fascists since the 1940s.
When
the military wasn't running the country after a coup, it has largely been run by fascists, and they've tended to run the country into the ground. The Peronist Party has been the majority political party of post-war Argentina. They are, you know, they like to build themselves as a middle way between capitalism and socialism. And so what they end up with is corporatism, where, you know, the government mediates between disputes between workers and businesses, you know, because the government can always be trusted to do that. How many times over the past 50, 70 years has Argentina's currency hyperinflated into worthlessness? They've had to issue an entirely new currency, which they immediately began hyperinflating into uselessness. And the funny thing is Sergio Massa, who was Milei's opponent, was talking about the Peronists, and he was saying, what you don't understand is we're the professionals at running business and the economy. Yeah, we can tell because you've done such a bang-up job for the for the last 70 years. So now they have a libertarian. Okay, great. And he describes himself as an anarcho-capitalist, which, okay, that's fine. But
it's kind of an oxymoron, isn't it? Not in the term itself, but to be running a government as an anarcho-capitalist or an anarcho-libertarian.
Yeah, it doesn't make much sense. And I have to wonder, you know, how successful the guy can possibly be in a country that's basically been run as a fascist country or a military dictatorship for 70 years. Sure, I get that a lot of people are tired of having a constantly deflating or devaluing currency. So I guess occasionally it's time for a change, but boy, it seems like it's just a really hard thing to do in a country like that to have a president who will turn the country around economically and come up with economic policies that will fit it. I think there's probably so much social and cultural inertia that no matter how many people might vote for you on election day, and he did get a majority, 56%. So, I mean, it was a fairly good majority. How long does that stay in a country that's used to having the government do a lot of stuff that he apparently says the government shouldn't do anymore? And how are they going to fight back against that? And the reason that I ask that about Argentina is that it kind of reminds me of the United States whenever the voters elect a bunch of Republicans to Congress. And they have an absolute majority in Congress, and maybe even the presidency. And then somebody gets this wild idea that, hey, maybe 70% of all government spending shouldn't be Social Security, Medicare, and interest on the national debt. Maybe we should take a look at reforming Social Security. And no matter how many people have voted Republicans in, no matter how big a majority they have, as soon as they start talking about stuff like that, they lose support immediately. You know, they've called Social Security like the third rail of American politics. And my question is not specifically about Argentina or really about the United States. It's really a cultural question. When you already have a culture that is so used to having a big, active government with involvement everywhere, how likely is it that you can, absent an absolute catastrophe, convince voters that, hey, all these goodies you've been getting, you're going to have to give up some of them. We can't afford them.
Yeah, that typically doesn't go over well. And that's why it's used as a cudgel in political races, because, hey, look, we gave you this stuff, or, you know, we're here to support you and take care of you. They want you to go alone. And they just want to cut off, you know, all the help. So, I mean, and that is culturally, you get, I guess, kind of lulled into, I guess, a frog getting lulled into the boiling pot in a way. And you get used to that. It's really hard to just cut it off.
Yeah, everybody wants to balance the budget until balancing the budget means they don't get any more free stuff.
Right. And very few people actually care about balancing the budget, to be quite honest. It's not high on the list of a lot of voters' requirements or desires, because they don't see how it makes any difference.
Yeah, well, it wasn't always that way. I mean, true. You know, one of the things that in the late 90s led to really the Republican majority from 1994, you know, through the 2000s was the promise of balancing the federal budget, which they, you know, kind of sort of did. But I mean, in the elections of 92 and 94 and 96 and 98, the idea of deficits were fairly high priority issues with voters. I mean, at least if you look at exit polling and any of the other polling that was done, both pre and post election, they felt that the deficit was just getting out of hand. That is a sea change to how voters feel now.
Yeah, they don't seem to care one way or the other. And some of that is because there's more immediate problems that are incredibly pressing. You know, the border is number one. The poor economy, which is related very much to our budget deficits, but they don't make that connection. Hopefully people are starting to make connection between the profligate spending of Congress and how that affects the economy with inflation and whatever. But I mean, you're right. I mean, it hasn't always been that way. When the Congressional Budget Act was passed in the 70s, it was a bigger concern then. And it was certainly a bigger concern in the mid 90s, but right now there's so many pressing things. I mean, World War III looks like it's about to break out any day right now.
Yeah, unfortunately that is true. It does look like that. And of course we've just gone through the pandemic and we needed all that extra money like pandemic relief and the TARP loans and things like that because they decided to shut the economy down.
Mm-hmm.
And just, you know, close everything. I mean, these are all government decisions. And then, of course, they felt apparently obligated to just throw, you know, $1.5 trillion at that to try to keep people from going hungry. At this point, we're now $33 trillion in debt. I guess we're going to end up cutting the budget at some point because there won't be any other choice.
Yeah, I mean, we're sort of a victim of our own success, right? Because no matter what, people are going to invest money. Countries and banks are going to buy treasuries to shore up their creditworthiness. So when we have the best opportunities.
Not if the currency collapses, they won't. Why would you buy?
Well, that's true. Why would it's good right up until it's not. But
yeah, I mean,
we're still better than any other place.
Well, yeah. At the moment, the trouble is, what do we do when that changes? Because if we look, we are one or two bad bond auctions away from 20% interest rates. Mm-hmm. And nobody is going to want to buy a 7.25 30-year treasury in the secondary market. Certainly not at the face value. They're going to want to buy that at, you know, such a steep
discount.
Yeah, because the yield has to be, you know, 15, 20%, whatever it is. Then on top of that, all of the outstanding debt that the U.S. government currently has, a good chunk of which is not actually in 30 years, but is in 10-year notes. What are we going to do when those interest rates jump back up to 7% or higher, 10%, 12%? We're now talking about $1.5 or $2 trillion a year just in servicing the debt. I don't know how that gets paid. I don't know how we avoid a default. And once we default, the number of people who are going to want to tritty trot over to Manhattan to pick up, you know, 10-year and 30-year notes is going to decline precipitously.
Pretty much. I mean,
we talked about Argentina. There's a reason nobody buys Argentine bonds.
That's right. Yeah, that's exactly right. And I mean, right now, I don't know how you avoid that. I mean, we're not slowing down spending at all.
And we've already had one credit downgrade in the last couple of weeks.
Yeah. And the Fed's barely doing anything as far as interest rates. Matter of fact, didn't they just... They just left things the same this last meeting. So, I mean, how do you bring that inflation out?
Well, Paul Volcker did it in 1979 through 1982.
But he let the interest rates rise.
Yeah. I mean, is that a price we're willing to pay? Because, you know, if you're...
I don't think so. Not to what they have to rise to.
Yeah. I mean, in 1981, your 30-year mortgage was 19%.
Mm-hmm.
And that was a mortgage.
Right. It actually had an asset backing it.
Yeah, exactly. Imagine what unsecured debt was. I mean, I don't know what the numbers were, but I would assume that like credit card debt was soaring into the high 20s at about that point.
Oh, yeah, it had to be. Right? Although, I mean, for credit card, most people didn't even have credit cards then, did they?
Yeah, well, it was the 1980s. Fewer credit cards in 1980 than there are today. There's been an explosion over the past, which, by the way, is another problem with the explosion of consumer credit. Although, one thing you do have to say about, you know, inflation, especially really steep inflation, it sure does make it easier to pay off, especially like mortgages, fixed debt, cars. That becomes super easy to pay off because
that was the Carter.
Well, yeah.
Excuse, right?
Yeah, it was.
See, I mean, look, what's so great is now your money can go a lot further for those debts.
Inflation.
Like your mortgage.
Inflation is our friend, as Dan Aykroyd famously said. yeah, but look, if you had a mortgage in 1976 for 7.5%, then inflation, or heck, try 73 at like, you know, 4%. That mortgage payment by
$10,000 for your house.
Yeah, that mortgage payment by 1983 was a hell of a lot easier to pay, because, you know, your $800 a month or $600 a month, well, that was, you know, worth considerably less work to produce $600 a month than it had been in 1973. I mean, you had a period over the course of about 10 years where the average annual blue collar wage went from $20,000 a year to $35,000 a year. That's a huge leap in inflation over the course of a decade. And so, yeah, if you have a fixed debt, then great. Paying that off is fine. And look, the interest rate that even on your revolving debt, the interest rate that's on the debt you've already taken, even that becomes easier to pay off. Certainly, you don't want to do any new spending on the credit card with, 30% interest rates, but your old interest at, 16 or 18 or whatever it was, that begins to look awfully reasonable. If you're mm-hmm. But if you're the financial system, on the other hand, it looks like a freaking disaster.
Yeah, well, especially because it's harder to get new credit out there. You're starting to see that in the housing market, which was already sort of strangled, and it's getting worse because people won't sell their homes because getting a new home requires an amazingly higher interest rate. All those years of 2, 3, 4% mortgages, that's gone. And that means that in order to buy another house, sell your house and buy another house, you're not only losing on the sales price because of higher interest rates, you're also losing when you go and buy a new house because of the interest rates. So it's starting to make home loans drop in initial new home loans. And I don't see it getting any better.
Yeah, and ultimately that's going to mean house prices have to come down, and they're already outrageous. I'm glad that we bought our house in 2001.
Yeah, we got ours in 2005.
Yeah, and the only thing I've done with that mortgage since 2001 is refinance it to a 15 at, I forget what our interest rate is, but I did it after 2008. So our interest rate is ridiculously low on a 15. So, okay, yeah, sure. For me, that worked. Now, I probably could not sell this house and buy another house in California. I mean, I suppose I could. I don't think I'd be able to buy it outright, but I'd have enough of a down payment that the lion's share of the house would be paid for. I could move out of California because California real estate prices are so high. I could go to, Kansas, Nebraska, whatever, and probably buy, a 40-acre farm if that's what I wanted and own it outright. But for most people, oh, excuse me. That was a bad inhale. For most people, even if you have a house and you're already in the market, you're already invested, and you have equity, I mean, you've got a little bit of a foot up, but I mean, 20 years ago, you would have been free to move from house to house almost at will. That's just no longer true.
Yeah, absolutely. I mean, you really do have to go to a completely different market in order to really get any benefit. Either that or move way out into the sticks.
Oh yeah, you would have to move out to a rural area in your locality to try to make to try to be able to afford that. And of course, if you're a first time home buyer, you're in your tw late 20s or early 30s when you're looking to finally buy a house so that you'll own it by the time you retire. I don't know what you do. I mean, I was looking at rents, just rents for apartment rents here, and a one-bedroom apartment is now going in the little suburb of San Diego, well, far north of San Diego where I live. It's $2,500 a month.
For a one bedroom?
Yeah, for one bedroom. So you wonder why are kids staying with their parents until they're 26? Well, housing, house prices.
Yeah, it's absolutely right.
And we're not building enough new housing to repair it. And of course, all of this is just a follow-on from what has really been a low interest rate, easy money regime that we've had since 2008.
What do we have to show for it?
Yeah, worse and
A lot
worse.
more debt.
Yeah, a lot more debt.
I mean, that's really all we got out of it.
And all that debt has to be paid back, or if it can't be paid back, it's all going to have to be defaulted on. And the federal government, at this point, absent deciding we're going to turn into Sweden and have, 40, 50, and 60% tax rates for everybody, even the lowest income earners, there's no way we're going to pay this back. I mean, this point, I don't even know how we stop the national debt from growing. So,
just paying interest on the debt is going to, you necessarily have to make the debt grow. I mean, we could slash a lot of stuff, I suppose, but when 70% of your budget is automatically entitlements that have to be paid for, doesn't leave a lot of wiggle room because the rest is basically defense.
Yeah, well, defense, well, see, you say that. Here's the thing. When you actually, and this is one of the things that really irks me. How can we spend so much money on defense? Well, in actuality, first of all, we spend 70% of our federal budget on spending by law, mandated spending.
Right.
That's 70% of it. Entitlements, yeah. Of the remaining 30%, 35% of that is national defense.
Right.
So 35 of 30% is actually about 15% of all federal spending.
Right.
So it's, I mean, sure, 15% is a big number. I mean, technically, mm-hmm. we could go the Costa Rica route and cut that back to zero. I'm not sure that would be a good policy idea. We could do it. Okay, but now we've saved 15%. Great. We have now reclaimed one-third of the annual deficit of $1.5 trillion.
Right.
So,
and doesn't put us in any good situation.
Yeah, well, I say one-third.
And the thing is that we've actually kept... military spending has stayed, at least in nominal dollars, has stayed relatively flat for a good long while, especially when you consider the challenges that we're facing right now. And we have... our Navy is so much smaller. Our armed forces in general are smaller. We don't meet recruiting goals. So we don't have as many personnel.
Yeah, the Army announced this past week that they were 25% below their recruiting goals.
And we don't have anywhere near the equipment that we once had. A lot of that has gone to Ukraine. I mean, our military spending especially looks like a lot compared to, the rest of the world. But one thing that nobody ever takes into account is our spending on military means that Europe and the other NATO countries don't have to. So we're basically paying for it for them.
And so
that inflates our budget.
And let's point out that our military spending for the last 50 or 60 years has remained fairly steady at around 3% of GDP.
That's right.
So
yeah, and it's always the military that's...
with their 80,000 new agents.
Right. You don't see that at the NEA, which shouldn't exist.
And yet does. I still remember it was the day after Inauguration Day, and the Department of Education, which had been created during Jimmy Carter's term as president, Ronald Reagan ran one of his platform items when he ran for president in 1980 was the elimination of the Department of Education. Not a federal responsibility, state and local responsibility. Feds have nothing to do with it. And I remember the day after the inauguration, his nominee for Secretary of Education walked into a meeting with all of the, GS-12s and higher in a big auditorium, and he walked in and the first words out of his mouth was, "All you people work here?" And everybody went, "Oh, ha, 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 ha." Oh. But there was no need for that groan because, as it turns out, Ronald Reagan wasn't going to get rid of it anyway.
Yeah. Closest thing to everlasting life is a government program.
Yeah, exactly. So, I don't know that Javier Milei can really, with the culture, the political culture of Argentina, I don't see how he can really fix things. I think he's a Trump vote, right? Things are
That's
bad.
exactly what I think. And so he's going to run into not only
And by the way, so was
just the general
Bolsonaro in
culture.
Brazil. And so was
That's right.
Bolsonaro in Brazil. These
And
are,
well, you saw what happened to him.
yeah, these are all Trump, you know, these are all Trump votes. And we saw what ultimately happened to Trump, and we saw what ultimately happened to Bolsonaro. And I have no doubt that we'll see the same thing with Milei, because you can't change culture via politics. It works the other way around.
Right. Except for it's not just the, culture, but it's also institutional culture. So the dug-in bureaucratic heels aren't going anywhere, and they will fight tooth and nail to keep their sinecures. And we also saw that happen here. We saw that happen in Brazil. So it's not just, the voters. It's also the entrenched interests of the bureaucracy.
And they all have civil service protection. They're all part of a union, so you can't just fire people willy-nilly. There's this whole process that you have to go through. Public sector unions were never a good idea. And
Even FDR hated them.
yeah, because public unions are inherently a playground for corruption. There's just no way that they can't
It's
be.
unavoidable. I mean, it's absolutely unavoidable. I mean, you give money to the people you want to give money to you.
Yeah, I mean,
It's like the most straightforward transfer of power you could possibly have.
you support the election of people who are going to send you government money, and you
Right.
oppose the election of people who think that maybe you're getting too much money as it is.
Right. It's just there's no in between there. There's no guessing, no conspiracy theories, nothing. It's just a straightforward transfer.
Sure, and that's how you end up with things like the California Department of Forestry's firefighters who can retire after 30 years at 85% of their highest 3 years salary.
3 years, right.
Yeah, so you can get a job as a firefighter at 20, and that means that you can retire at 50 with 85% of your highest 3 years of pay. Oh, and health insurance.
The same for most police departments as well.
Oh yeah, it's a great deal. It really is. It's a deal that no one outside the government has. And here's the irritating
It's
thing.
true.
You know, it used to be that if you got a government job, especially at the federal level, I mean, there was this deal you had to make. I'm going to make way less money on an annual basis than anybody who's doing a similar job in the private sector. In return for being poorer and worse paid, you'll never be able to fire me, and I will get a
Right.
nice and I'll get a nice retirement. And somehow
That's right.
we've even broken that deal. Oh no, you're not getting paid enough. After all, we got to pay workers fairly, and they have a union, and you know, we, even though that many of them are prohibited by law from striking, it's amazing how many of them get the flu on the same day, right?
Right.
So, and of course, you know, they're giving money to the union. The union is supporting the election of politicians who are going to give more money to the union's members in terms of pay and benefits. And so you get this never-ending cycle of politics. That's one of the reasons why I feel that one of the changes that we could make that would be very salutary would be to have a campaign finance law, both at the state and federal level, that says you, as an individual, can give money to anybody you like. But no corporation, no private union, no PAC can spend money for, you know, a political candidate. You can only donate to a candidate via individual donations. And all of those individual donations, and it can be to any candidate in any amount that you would like, but all those individual donations have to be made public. That still
I mean,
doesn't
I
solve the super PAC problem.
no, because you still got the ability to go out there and speak your message.
And
And
campaign
that's
coordination with the super PACs are still technically illegal, although it appears to me a law that is more honored in the breach than the observance.
It's hard to, always, unless it's like a direct, hey, and vote for Joe Biden or for Donald Trump. Unless it's something direct like that, saying, hey, I support, we as an organization support these issues, and anybody who supports these issues, you should give serious consideration to electing. I mean, it's hard to
Yeah,
separate out.
as long as you don't mention a party or
Right.
a candidate.
Right. So you can kind of stealthily, and everybody knows where you stand and who you're really talking about. And I think that's an insolvable problem because, mean, we do have free speech, and I'm not in the mood, in this day and age to start making exceptions.
No, and I get the doctrine that money itself becomes
Is
speech,
speech, right?
Citizens United. I'm not sure it's entirely true, and I'm sure that it is true for individuals. I'm not sure it's true collectively. Individuals have rights. Do groups have rights? Well, group people do have the individual right of association. I mean, yeah, I understand how murky it gets. I guess I mean, you'll never be able to stop people from making commercials about issues with their buddies.
Correct.
You'll never be able to do that. But there's supposed to be a
And you're never able
firewall.
to stop a bunch of them getting together and making commercial about their issues.
Yeah, but I tell you
I
what you
mean,
can do with public sectors, you can disband their public sector unions so that group no
absolutely.
longer exists. And if they want to create a PAC, well, you know what? Get together and create one. But it won't be
Well, if
your
you're a public
union.
sector union, you shouldn't be able to give money to any political cause, period. I
Well,
mean, why?
yeah, that's the thing. If you in the military, the people who defended this free country, I remember I wanted to put a political bumper sticker on my car once. And I did it after I went through and received the appropriate permission and ensured that it was only going to be on my privately owned motor vehicle, and then I could
Right.
put it up. There are serious restrictions on political speech by military members, just as a matter of policies. One of the things that you do when you sign that contract to join the military is, hey, I realize that my political speech is going to be stifled, and I cannot participate in any sort of political rally or movement or campaign event or speech, and wear my uniform to that event, for example. There's a whole bunch of things that you can do, and I don't know why having a job with the federal or state government what can't have those kind of restrictions either. Just like, look, if you're going to work in the bureaucracy is non-political, so
Right.
no political campaign donations or anything like that. You're just restricted from that because we have to maintain institutional neutrality.
Well, especially for the organizations themselves. And you brought it up before about, and I'm wondering this for 20 years, why, actually longer, why do corporations get to give money to political causes at all? I understand that certain issues affect them. And they should be able to, throw up advertisements about those specific things. That's fine. But why should they be able to give money for elections at all? I mean,
Yeah, like the whole Facebook thing in the 2020 election, where they were just throwing, billions of dollars at states to, help them with their elections.
Right.
You're a corporation. First of all, that not only is that not in your remit, but what about your shareholders? Why
Yeah, that's exactly right.
isn't that profit that is distributed to your shareholders? What about your fiduciary responsibility? It's one of the reasons why I hate ESG among investing firms like Vanguard and BlackRock with their environmental and social governance policies, which they have started to back off from. Wait a second. You have a fiduciary responsibility to the investors, especially if you're a company like Vanguard. I mean, when you look at how Vanguard gets the vast majority of its money, it comes from 401ks. which means that it is a one of a limited set of options that an employee gets to try to invest some of their money for retirement. They have no control over how that money is spent. They have no say in the companies in which the, in this case, Vanguard, because Vanguard is very big in 401ks. They don't have any say in who Vanguard invests in. It's not like having an account at Vanguard, right? A personal account.
Right.
Where you can just call, say, buy this or buy that or invest in this fund. Don't invest in that fund. You don't have that level of control. You're locked into this cafeteria list of, you know, X number of investments, and that's it. And once you, now, every, you know, year, every month or so, you have the ability to shift your investments and move it from one to another, but you got to stay inside that
one
list.
Of three buckets.
Yeah, one of three buckets.
And low yield, low risk, or, you know, middle, high yield, high risk. I mean, you don't get to select specific funds or anything.
Right. And so what Vanguard now gets is trillions of dollars from people who literally have no control over what Vanguard does with their money. And then Vanguard, if they decide that they want to only invest in companies that have the appropriate environmental and social governance, and that becomes an investment criteria, not returns, then it seems to me that they are violating their fiduciary responsibility to all of those millions and millions of workers who are entrusting them with their 401ks in the hope that they will not have to eat Alpo when they're 65. And by the way, this is something that before he started running for president and turned into some sort of lunatic, that Vivek Ramaswamy was really big on. Was really big on, which was that these investment companies should not be doing this. The only criteria.
Not going to be president anyway.
Samir Naga, not going to work here anymore anyway. His idea was that, yeah, you should not have, your only responsibility as an investment company like Vanguard or whatever is to look for the highest returns that you can get for the people who are being forced, essentially, to give you your money with no control over what you do with it. It's one thing if you want to invest your own money, however much money it is, into ESG companies. That's your money. Knock yourself right out. It's another thing entirely when you have a captive pot of money that belongs to someone else, and then you can use someone else's money to further your social goals.
Right.
That's a problem.
And that's what unions do.
And yeah, that's exactly what unions do. They take other people's money in the union. And by the way, it's not like you have a choice.
No.
You have to pay your union.
Although you
dues.
Do in some places now. I mean, yeah. That was Scott Walker's big thing, right? In Wisconsin, was to stop the automatic enrollment of new teachers and whatever it was.
Yeah,
I think it was teachers.
Yeah, in his case, it was the teachers union, and it was mandatory that you give union dues to teachers unions.
Right.
And he stopped that. And look, in some states, they've done that. That's not a nationwide deal.
No. That's, but it does help. It was amazing how much money the unions lost after that. People are like, yeah, I really don't want to give my money to the union. I'd rather take that home myself and spend for my own contract.
Yeah, well, the whole point about voluntary contributions, and this is what Scott Walker argued, and I think he was absolutely correct, is if you're forced to give me money, I really don't have to do a damn thing for you. I don't have to listen to you. I don't have to allay any concerns you have, because your concerns are irrelevant. You're forced to give me that money. The idea behind making these contributions voluntary is, of course, I now have to respond to you. And if I want your money, you have to feel that there is value in giving it to me, because I'm returning something of value to you in return for it.
If only taxes worked that way.
Yeah. Now, of course, the downside of that, and teachers unions are a great example of that. Teachers unions always come and say, you know, we care so much about the children. You know, Randy Weingarten is a master of that. Oh, the children, the children. But wait a second, you're a union president. You're not the president, by the way, of the children's union. You're the president of the teachers' union. And your job is to procure goodies for teachers, not students.
Yeah. Often at the expense of students.
Yeah, often at the expense of students. And look, you can look at COVID and states that were trying to send people back to school, and people like Randy Weingarten say, no, it's very unsafe. We can't do this. We need to stay home and collect our paychecks, because commuting into work to the school every day is
dangerous.
Well, it's not actually the commuting that's dangerous. That's just something we no longer wish to do. But being in class with students, yeah, that's the dangerous bit. So, and now, of course, this last week, we saw this thing about student learning loss throughout the pandemic because of the lack of actual schooling. And I mean, these numbers.
Well, what we saw was a delayed, finally, recognition of something that we already knew for the last year and a half.
Yeah, we now have confirmation of a blinding glimpse of the obvious. If you don't have in-person schooling, you're probably going to lose a lot of students, and you're going to lose a lot of progress because you can't monitor them.
You put face diapers on 2 and 3 year olds who are developing, especially when they're developing language and communication skills and social skills. Having everybody's face covered up really makes that hard.
You know, and the really weird thing about that is because in the military, this is what I was taught. In college, this is what I taught when I taught communications. Just the actual words that are coming out of your mouth are not the only part of communication, right?
Right.
It's a tone of voice. It's your visual expression. It's your body language. There's all of this very complex information that you receive. And you don't receive that information if half of your face is completely covered. And if you're a young child,
right,
just learning to communicate, you're actually cutting off most of the nonverbal cues of human communication. And what you're left is with the mere sound of words that are, you know,
right,
coming out of a person's mouth. You can't even look
at... And that's assuming that those words are coming out correctly
and clearly,
in a articulate manner, when most people do not speak that way. I mean, I typically watch people's mouths because I can sort of read what they're saying so that I don't screw up and think they mean one thing when they're clearly trying to say something else. But if I just listen to it, I'm going to be really confused. You know?
Yeah. So, you know, teachers' unions don't work for kids. They work for teachers, and they do what's best for teachers. Kids are, if thought of at all, are at best an afterthought. And this is true for any public union. You know, the police unions are always talking about how concerned they are about public safety. And those concerns always seem to be alleviated with higher pay, more benefits, and more time off.
Mm-hmm.
There's a direct correlation.
Funny how that works.
Yeah, there's just this direct correlation between police pay and benefits and public safety. How could you deny it? Unless you're one of those police defunders.
Well, you know, what's worse is that the union for kids is basically the parents. And it's their communications with the local school boards, the local principal of your school. You know, those are the communications where the kids are advocated for. But those are very tightly controlled by the union teachers. And
if they can't be controlled, they...
Yeah, we'll just arrest them.
They veer off into domestic terrorism.
That's pretty much it.
I mean, that's what the FBI said. You know, all these parents who are speaking out at school boards, you know, we got to look at them. That's a key sign of domestic terrorism.
They used my name in open forum. They can't do that.
Yeah, well, it just...
Ma'am, you're an elected official.
Yeah, exactly. You know, there's so few people... One of the funniest things on YouTube are these people who go and film in public. Right? They just go out, they take a camera, they just stand on a public sidewalk, and they start filming stuff. And the number of times that either A, some citizen comes out, walks all the way across the parking lot, all the way across the green strip to go and say, "You can't film here. You're pointing your camera at our building.
Stop filming me."
Yeah, stop filming me. I have not given you permission to film me. And then,
yeah,
of course,
you don't know any of this works.
Yeah, and then of course the police show up, and 85% of the time, the cops are like, "Why are you here? Why are you filming? This looks suspicious. What are you doing?
What's your mistake?"
Yeah, none of your business. I'm in public. You have no expectation of privacy. And the cops, and I've even seen cops wearing body cams saying, "You have no permission to film me." that works both ways then, Sparky. But, you know, people don't understand what their rights are or anything like that. But, you know, all of these problems, when we look, this is why people like Javier Milei get elected. And it's why people like Trump are at 54% in New Hampshire in the polling. Now, look, this is not a summer poll. We're now getting into November. We're now 2 months out from New Hampshire. And polling is still giving Trump 54% combined.
And he's not even really campaigning either. Which may be why his numbers are going up.
His time is limited for at least four good reasons. So, he's not doing a lot of campaigning. And look, all of these other people, even Nikki Haley, who is unaccountably at 35%. I mean, at this point, they look like also rans. Now, look, we've seen similar things before where somebody had, you know, 50% lead in the polls in New Hampshire and then came in second or third. I mean, it happens. We don't know until the actual election takes place. Because polls haven't been, you know, great. But it's like we've talked about before. If you have a government that simply can't solve problems, then people are going to start looking around for non-traditional politicians who can solve problems, or who at least they think can solve problems. And sometimes...
Or who I think even it's, I think the expectations are even lower than that. It's that they won't keep doing the same damn things and telling us it's what's best for us. You know, I think that's the kind of universal worldwide Trump vote. It is, you know, non-political elites is who we want in there. We're kind of sick of your whole class of people running things because you're not doing a damn good job of it. And you seem to be better off, but we don't.
Well, here's the thing about that. You say they're not doing a damn good job of it. And this last week in San Francisco, in the space of about 48 hours, San Francisco turned from this into this. Where'd all that paint go? Where are all those tents and whatnot? How did we get to this attractive cityscape in San Francisco?
Yeah. And well, for a week anyway.
Yeah, for a week. But I mean, here is what it does tell us. All of these problems, homeless encampments in the streets, a completely uncontrolled border, whatever, doesn't really matter. This can all be fixed. It can all be fixed very quickly. They just don't want to.
Yeah, that's the problem. They say they're going to address it because they know what the voters want. They just don't want to give it to them. They want to pretend that they're giving it to them. Oh, see, we don't do it directly. We have to do it this way first, and then this step, and then this step, and then you're going to have to vote me some more power.
Yeah, it's very, very complex, we're told. Right. It's super.
I mean, this is the whole runaround we've got with Obamacare, and we still have Obamacare.
Yeah, well, you know, it's super complex right up until the minute that Chairman Xi is going to come visit. And then stuff just happens like magic. And I am, for some reason, on the wrong page. Not sure why. There we go. That's the page I'm supposed to be on. In the space of 24 to 48 hours, we can fix this. We can fix the cities. We can move the homeless out. We can make these neighborhoods. We can do it. We just
prefer, what the hell's going on behind you right now?
We just prefer not to.
You've got an ad going on in your back.
I do have an ad. It's a video. That just happened to be where it was playing on the. That just happened to be where it was playing on the webpage. It just conveniently was playing right behind my head. That's just its location. So we know that they can fix these problems. We know that they can do anything that they want to do if they would do it. They could stop people coming in from the border within 30 days. Undeniably, they could do it.
Yeah.
They simply choose not to. And you get people like Mayorkas who'll go in, stand before Congress and say, oh, yes, we're very, very serious about the border. Oh, my God, you have no idea how serious we are about the border. If you were, you'd fix it because it's not rocket science.
Well, and if you were, you wouldn't have to have a federal circuit court tell you to stop cutting razor wire on the border and to help illegal immigrants in.
To give them fist bumps as they come through the razor wire that you've just cut.
I mean, how is that just not directly illegal and treasonous?
Well, first of all, I believe it is illegal. If you are a Border Patrol officer and your job is to prevent people from illegally crossing the border, and you are cutting barbed wire to open up a safe path and fist bumping them as they come in, seems to me that you are an accomplice to violating the Immigration Act of 1986.
I would say the same.
I mean, why not just go grab your privately owned vehicle and give them a ride to wherever they want to go? Oh, wait, you don't have to do that because your agency will do it.
Yeah.
It's, you know, it's insane. It's funny, you know, Cheech Marin had a music video back in the late 1980s. It was a takeoff of parody of
Mexican American.
It was a parody of Bruce Springsteen's Born in the USA, and his song was Born in East LA. And the whole thing was he went to Mexico for a visit, came back, and they wouldn't let him back in the country, and he had to sneak in.
Movie.
Yeah, he had to sneak in like an illegal immigrant and get caught by the Border Patrol and deported to Mexico again. I don't know if that's what the Border Patrol was like in the 1980s, but that sure as hell ain't what it's like now.
No, not at all. Actually, in the movies, they called INS on themselves because like one of their family members had a wedding in Mexico, so they got a free ride across the border. And then they just come back in.
Yeah, well, now it wouldn't be a problem. You could go back and forth pretty much at will now.
Well, you just won't get that free ride out of the state across the country.
So these problems are all fixable. We just won't do it. And
no.
We won't do it because...
And cui bono.
Yeah, exactly.
Whose interests are served?
We won't do it because...
It's not yours. It's not mine. It's not low-income Americans. It's a very small subset of Americans who want cheap labor and... They want price pressure on wages.
And who have plenty of money
to throw... Lots of seasonal workers.
And who have plenty of money to throw around in politics to ensure that that continues.
Yeah.
And so, you know, how do you get Donald Trump? This is how you get Donald Trump. This is how you get, you know, Bolsonaro. This is how you get Milei. Because people understand that... Whatever else the government might be doing, it's not working for them. It's not doing, You have one job in the government, and they aren't doing that job. There's a very small, select group of people whose interests get served. And many people are waking up to that. What worries me is that the Gen Z people are not waking up to that at all.
Well, talk about a culture that has only ever known mommy and daddy government. I mean, these people don't remember the Cold War. They probably don't know much about it. They certainly don't remember anything from the 90s. And what? As far as they know, you know, we've always been at war in Iraq and Afghanistan.
Well, it's actually, but it actually goes deeper than that. I was looking, watching an interview with Niall Ferguson today, and one of the things that he mentioned was how most people don't understand how far left the educational institution has gone, and how deeply the progressive oppressed oppressor dynamic has been drilled into the heads of everyone from elementary school all the way through college. And they simply have a single tool that they've been given through our educational system, which is largely a system of indoctrination, as far as I'm concerned, at least our public education system. And the only tool they've been given is the oppressed oppressor lens with which to view everything. Now, yep. I think it's fascinating that they never point the oppressed oppressor lens to certain countries or continents. Right? Nobody looks at
organizations.
Nobody looks at Germany or France or England through the oppressed oppressor dynamic.
Well, they do there.
No, they don't even there. Look, one of the things about this whole Hamas-Israel thing is that Israel are colonizers. They're the oppressors. And it has to be, that area has to be decolonized. So let's set aside for the fact that decolonization as a concept is inherently genocidal.
Right.
What if we turn that colonization lens towards, say, Great Britain? Who are the people who have traditionally lived in Great Britain? And who are the colonizers who have come in recent years and begun to change that society? Now, we can't ask that question. But in what?
Or look at Sweden. Sweden and Norway are asking that question now.
Yeah. Who's actually being colonized here?
Right.
Who are the colonizers? Is it the people who have lived here for thousands and thousands of years, or the people who just immigrated here 20 years ago and now they get to run the show? How is that not colonization?
Right.
But we don't turn the lens in that way. We only turn the oppressed oppressor lens in very specific directions, at very specific countries, in very specific geographical locations.
It's true.
It is an inconsistent application of that. And that's all these kids know. And so when you look at like polling, fully half of all of the Gen Zs who are polled, when asked, believe that Israel should be decolonized, that Hamas is right, Israel is wrong, and that they should turn the land back over to the Palestinians. Half. Okay, sure, they're all in their 20s now. 30 years, they're going to be running American foreign policy. And they are going to bring this ideology with them. The future,
unless something disabuses of them of those notions.
Yeah, but you know what?
In the real world, real soon.
Yeah, but, you know, in the real world, people who obtain these ideas and these worldviews in college largely maintain them through their entire lives.
It's true.
And they can't even think into a situation. I saw a tweet from some lady. I don't know who she is. She's got thousands of followers. She has a doctorate in psychology. And she wrote this tweet with all of the smugness of a liberal arts holder of postgraduate degrees. Never in my life have I ever launched a rocket, watched it explode, come back a couple of weeks later, launched a new rocket, and watched it explode. Okay, yeah, I'm sure you haven't, because you are intellectually and by training and experience incapable of building such a rocket in the first place. You have never failed at such an endeavor because it is utterly beyond your capabilities to even begin. That's not quite the flex you think it is.
Yeah, I don't even understand the flex, to be honest.
Yeah, well, it's just to ridicule Elon Musk. See, Elon Musk's rockets blow up. Yeah, how well do your rockets perform? Oh, that's right. You don't have anything because your doctorate is in psychology, perhaps the most low-stakes field in the humanities.
Sociology.
Okay, well, there is sociology. There's the whole Margaret Mead deal in sociology. And yet, this is the kind of monumental self-regard combined with a total lack of self-awareness that enables these kids, now that they've been fully indoctrinated, that enables them to view the world through a lens that is impervious to factual or rational analysis.
Yeah.
And the funny thing, there was another video this week. I probably should have collected all of these. It was in England, and it was one of these Extinction Rebellion people. And this cop in England was trying to explain to her rationally and logically, you're sitting here in the road doesn't actually do anything to help the cause of fossil fuels, because you're sitting here in the road and now all these cars are just sitting here idling. They're
idling away.
They're still burning fossil fuels. And now you are causing more damage by sitting here and preventing them from getting on their way than you would as if you had just let them drive to work. And she had a cow. She started weeping and screaming and crying. This is not sane.
Well, no, it's not. I mean, it's not rational. It's like you always say, you can't reason somebody out of a position they didn't reason themselves into. And what you're attacking is dogma. You're attacking the underlying tenets of a faith. You're not attacking a political position. You're going after their entire worldview.
Yeah, it was so nice, by the way. But this was on Trigonometry. I was watching. So it was Constantine Kissin and the fellow who hosts Trigonometry with him, who I never can remember. And they were talking to Niall Ferguson. And I was so pleased to hear Niall Ferguson talk about this and then say, well, this is much like a secular religion. Yes. Yes, much like, how about exactly like? That's what it is. It is a dogma that cannot be questioned. And if you question it, you must be evil.
Right.
Because it's impervious to rational argument.
Yeah, absolutely. I mean, it's impervious to argument, period. I mean, it's an a priori given that this is correct. There's nothing else you can do about that. This is just established.
And if you disagree, it must be because of either some moral failing or intentional
right.
moral turpitude on your part. Because they cannot...
Nefarious...
good faith argument...
Desire.
No good faith argument is possible.
Right.
And, how do you run a... Well, you don't. You don't run a free society with free speech and open debate if that becomes your governing philosophy. You can't.
No, and that's why it's very important to the left and some on the right that all speech be controlled. Because you can't get through if your ideas may be challenged. And they can't have that. Because you can't argue that I'm just right. That's not an argument. And since there are no other arguments to back up their stance, you don't have a choice.
And they've
You've
never
got
been given
to knock it down.
And they've never been given countervailing arguments.
No, they've never even faced them.
No,
they're just told no. But that's the only thing. That's the thing that a racist would say. That a white supremacist
exactly.
would say.
Exactly. They don't need to engage on ideas because their ideas are so obviously correct that there can be no good faith opposition to them.
Right.
I I mean, you can certainly run a society on that ideology. In fact, we did it in the Soviet Union for, 70 years. It can be done.
Iran does it now.
Iran does it now. It can be done. It's not very great for the people who live under it, but you can certainly do it. And that's the way that we're heading. And I wish I knew where the off ramp was for that, but that's the way that we're heading.
Yeah, me too. I mean, we're the last bastion of freedom. I mean, we're literally the only country in the world with a First Amendment or some sort of analog. That alone and the Second Amendment are the biggest bulwark that we as citizens have against an overarching government. You can't find that anywhere else. Nowhere else.
No, although we are, I think, learning the limits of the utility of the Second Amendment. Because when you pull that tool out of your toolbox, all bets are off.
Right.
I mean, yeah, we have the tool, but once you pull it, that's going to be an unmitigated disaster. I mean, even if at the end of the day there's some sort of armed rebellion, and even if it turns out to be like the, American Revolution, which was historically unprecedented as far as revolutionary movements go, which ended up with a freer country than it started with, that's generally not what happens. But even if it did, in a modern society, the cost of achieving that would be so high that you almost have to wonder if it's worth it.
Well, the only way it would be possible is for it to work almost essentially like the American Revolution, where, we don't go there and invade England. We don't go and invade the capital. You make them come to you. And, they want your tax dollars. They want your homage. Well, come and get it.
Yeah. there are certainly ways of doing that in terms of insurgency that would. I'm always amused, especially after, 10 years on active duty, being told about how, it would be impossible to run an insurgency against the U.S. government. Oh, you think?
Yeah. Not all those soldiers are as loyal to politicians as you might think.
Yeah. Also, Iron Age tribesmen in Afghanistan managed to do it for 20 years. So it can't be that hard. But I think the cost in disruption of supply chains and everything like that, I mean, it would be such
a... devastating.
It would be such a disaster that, you...
Yeah, but could you imagine if, Iowa, Nebraska, Kansas, Oklahoma all get together and said, hey, well, you want your food? Here it is. Otherwise, starve, you city-dwelling maggots.
Yeah, well, I mean, there are options short of armed revolution that I think could be pursued, but nobody's pursuing those either. I mean, look, this whole convention of the states deal has been languishing for over a decade now.
Yeah, that's pretty much stalled.
Yeah, so people... And I think probably people are still at the stage of thinking, if we just elect the right person, this all goes away.
Yep.
And for now, the right person, at least on the right, appears to be Donald Trump. We can just get Trump back in. He'll do all of those things he said he would do in 2016 and didn't. But this time he will.
I won't, but
okay.
He'll certainly be freer.
Yeah,
he doesn't have to worry about being reelected.
Yeah, he'll be freer in the sense that he becomes a lame duck on day one, just like any second term president, right? We know he's going out in 4 years. We can always kick the can down the road for another 4 years. Although for some of the things that are going on now economically, in terms of spending, maybe we can kick the can down the road another 4 years. I don't know if that's true, though. So
it depends on how you do it, but I mean, not that... I don't think Trump would do anything about that. The closest he came was with the rule he put in about new federal regulations. If you're going to add one, you got to take off two, kind of thing. And I don't know how well that was honored, but it was a step in the right direction, at least.
Yeah, well, tossing them all away and forcing Congress to write those regulations would be the way the government is supposed to run. Not the secretary shall have power to enforce this legislation through appropriate regulation, which is how most things get done. One final thing, by the way, that I wanted to talk about this week, and that is that the new Speaker of the House is actually releasing all of the U.S. Capitol Police videos, and ultimately, and they're doing it slowly, ultimately, there are, I believe, 40,000 hours of video, and I can assure you, I am not going to watch all 40,000 hours of video. That's just not going to happen. But the videos that have been released have been really interesting. I'll just pull one up. And look, this is a mixed bag, as we'll see. This is not the one that I wanted, but I guess this is as good as any. So here are the Capitol Police. They're waiting. And if you look down here at the very end of the hall, and I think I probably picked the wrong one. Or maybe not. Yeah, I guess, sorry, I guess I did pick the wrong one. I knew I did one with the Hall of Columns south door. I just don't remember which one it was that I grabbed. I probably should have bookmarked that one. I can sort of fast forward my way through this. It's one of these, trust me, because I pulled it off the first page. A lot of these videos are unwatchable because they're just a bunch of cops standing around in a hallway. So they're super boring, which is the one that I was looking for. Was it this one? Where they're letting people, I mean, they're just letting people in and they're just walking in with these people. I don't even know that the sort order is the same as what I was looking at earlier. So, you know, there's a lot of this boring stuff. Maybe I should go to the Michael Tracy one. I found one where they were letting people in, and the cops are just walking with them. I mean, there's hours of just this scene here, where you know the cops are just standing around.
So maybe, scared.
Yeah, I can understand why so many of them committed suicide immediately after. Here are some from Michael Tracy on Twitter, who put this together. And he has these videos, and this is one where the cops are just basically bringing people in, and they're sort of walking ahead of them and following, and they're standing here, they're having their little conversations and whatnot, and people are, you know, taking their phones and showing pictures and stuff like that, and the cops are just standing there. I mean, there's a lot of this. But there's also, you know, a fair amount of this. And so, you know, that's a bunch of people that need to be arrested. So, you know, it is a mixed bag. But there were a lot of people who committed violent offenses who should have been dragged away from there. And when you look at these videos here, you know, you have to wonder, are the cops just saying, forget it, there's too many of them and not enough of us, it's better if we don't escalate and let them in? Or is this the cops being buddies? I don't know. There is a whole bunch of video. On the plus side, what we are now seeing is the video that's been hidden for 3 years. Unfortunately, they're releasing it much like lawyers do on a Friday afternoon to respond to discovery with a with just a document dump. So yeah, good luck finding anything in these 1 million documents. This is kind of the same thing. There's 40,000 hours of video, which tells me that out of that 40,000 hours of video, whatever your opinion is, you're probably going to be able to find plenty of evidence one way or another that your position is the correct one. But boy, it is so much more a mixed picture. There was one, and I wanted to find it, and I saw it, and then I went back to look for it, and of course it just disappeared in the mists of time, of these cops arresting somebody, hauling him away in handcuffs, taking him around the corner, undoing the handcuffs, letting him go. One cop shakes his hand. The other one gives him a fist bump. That fella may not have been a regular protester. I'm just saying. That's right.
They did admit that they had more federal assets there that they weren't really sure how many, with all the different agencies and departments. And yeah, we're going to do an audit, and I don't know if we'll come up with them all. I don't know. There was a bunch.
Yeah, there were a bunch. And, you know, how many of them? And look, if you're undercover in a thing like this, a big gathering like this, your most effective tactic is just to watch and note what happens. If you are saying, let's storm the Capitol, let's go, maybe you're not acting as an undercover operative in good faith.
Yeah, then you're, that's entrapment.
Yeah.
It's like back in the 60s and 70s when everybody would show up for these SDS meetings and whatever, and turns out that all but one of them were actual police.
Yeah, exactly. There were like, you know, sheriff's department, you know, LAPD intelligence guys from the intelligence division, feds, ATF guys. I forget what the exact story was, but it was like there were seven conspirators, six of whom worked for a federal or local law enforcement agency. None of them knew that all the others were cops.
It even just happened not too long. I think it was just a few months ago, where a drug indictment team had tried to take down a bunch of drug smugglers or dealers. Turned out every single one of them was cops, undercover cops.
Yeah, that is hilarious in one sense, but it's also frightening in another sense, because what it tells you is A, the left hand doesn't know what the right hand is doing, and B, there is a lot of potential entrapment going on that is just going under the radar.
Oh, absolutely. I mean, the biggest one that came to light was that whole Gretchen Whitmer kidnapping thing.
Yeah, where it turns out three of the five conspirators were FBI agents.
I think it was more like five of the eight.
Oh, yeah, something like that. It was basically two-thirds were FBI agents. Right. So it was like these two or three poor slobs that had, you know, five or six FBI agents egging them on to kidnap the governor of the state. And here's the thing, they put so much emphasis on this. There was a story that came out just yesterday or Friday about how the FBI was actually running an actual investigation on an actual pedophile who was actually creating and selling child pornography, and they just let that investigation drop so that they could concentrate on January 6th protesters.
I wonder which big name newspaper he was a reporter for.
Oh. Yeah, very nice one. There is an institutional problem with this concentration on domestic terrorism. And it's funny how the concentration on domestic terrorism tends not to be on what we now know to be hundreds of thousands of people who are willing to march through the streets of New York and Chicago demanding that, you know, all of the Jews be killed. But when 20 or 30 people, you know, who are from, you know, some white supremacist organization I've never heard of before, there was one that showed up in, Michigan or something yesterday. You know, they're like Crimson Dawn or some god awful stupid name like that. And there's like, you know, 20 of these guys. This is the danger. This is the danger that we are concentrating on.
Yeah. I've met Antifa people. I've met people who think Palestine should be from the river to the sea. I've never met an actual white supremacist. Not once.
I have. And for for some reason in the United States, the white supremacists have something against the military. So in the military, you occasionally run across these white supremacist people who want to do things like, you know, come onto a missile silo site. What they're going to do there, I have no earthly idea. Because they're not going to...
Suicide by military?
Yeah, well, I mean, we're not that trigger happy. We can be more trigger happy than the regular cops, especially when nuclear weapons are concerned, admittedly.
I would think so.
But we're not that trigger happy. But I mean, you know, I run across them occasionally. But they're always the big boogeyman. But, you know, you have massive... pro-Palestine protests, and oh yeah, it's free speech, which I guess,
yeah, well then let's be honest about what that speech is. I think that's the most confounding thing, is the euphemization of their message. Well, it doesn't really mean from the river to the sea. Yeah, no, it fucking well does.
It always
why
has.
They say,
yeah, it's always,
that's why they call it North Palestine, where Israel exists.
Yeah.
It's, you know, let's be honest. They want to wipe Jews off the map, period.
Yeah. And by the way, if you're an immigrant here and you are proposing that, we have no reason to keep you here.
No, matter of fact, we've got good reason and lawful reason to support you.
We have a lawful reason to kick you out of the country. But, you know,
especially if you're here on a student visa.
But look, just take what happened in England this past week. Suella Braverman, who was the home secretary, as they call it in Great Britain, she was tossed out of her job.
Great name, by the way.
She was tossed out of her job because she suggested that maybe they did need to stop immigration and maybe deport some of these people. Boom, she's gone.
Yeah, she was very straightforward. She was actually very forthright. I mean, she did not back off. I mean, she wasn't rude. She was just very straightforward.
Yeah, and that is, by the way, the law in the United Kingdom. I mean, unlike the United States, in the United Kingdom, Hamas is literally a proscribed group. It is literally illegal to publicly support them because they don't have a First Amendment. And according to UK law, those people should, in fact, by law, be rounded up and sent back home. And so merely mentioning that you might think that enforcing the actual law of the country is something you might want to do, that gets you sacked by the prime minister. And as one of our commenters said here, it's too late for the damage done. Going to take decades to recover. At best, assuming that a recovery is even possible, which is the one thing that really I think worries me more than anything right now, is whether
and then recover to what? I mean, I don't think we need to recover and go back to what we were before. I think we need to salvage what we can and move forward in a better direction, one where the federal government isn't so involved in our individual lives, where it's not so involved in state business, one where elections are uniform throughout the country and on one day.
Yeah, well, that would certainly be helpful, but clearly a topic we're going to need to discuss at another time, because I think we're out of time for today. So as always, Michael, pleasure talking to you. And we'll look forward to talking to you again, but not next week, because next week is Thanksgiving weekend, and we're not going to be here. I'm certainly not.
I won't.
So have a great Thanksgiving, and we will look forward to picking this back up again on December 3rd. So have a great holiday. We'll talk
to
you.
All right, you too, everybody. Have a good holiday, and we'll see you later. Bye.
So, as we've said, have a great holiday. We'll see you next time we're back. Until then, so long.